Hello, everyone. Welcome to
Cinematic Underdogs. I'm your host, Jordan Puga.
And I'm your other host, Paul Keelan. And we're here and we're back with Jed Bookout. I think it's our third time with Jed. We did High Flying Bird. We did Speed Racer. And now we're going to do A Field of Dreams. Welcome to the pod, Jed.
Hey, what's going on, guys? How you doing? Glad to be here again.
We're great. We're excited to talk about this classic in the pantheon of sports movies, maybe on many people's top 10 lists. But
we talked about this last time. It's on everyone's top 10 list who comes on this podcast. It's probably like the most mentioned, that and Rocky, I think. We haven't done enough real digging into the statistics, but I'm getting the vibe that Rocky and Field of Dreams are like the quintessential sports films for people.
Absolutely. And it's such a dad film. It's such a late 80s film. It's such an Americana film. And yet there are some out there who have really quirky, interesting readings like Jed that really shine a new light on this film. So I'm excited for everyone to hear that. But before we get there, we're going to try to set the scene. We're going to bring us to the box office of 1989, early 1989 in April. And we're going to talk about some of the movies that were out at the time so that everyone could hopefully get a feel for the zeitgeist at the time. Because most of us hadn't seen the films that came out on the same weekend as Field of Dreams, almost all of us had seen none of the films. I think, Jed, you saw Pet Sematary, correct?
Pet Sematary is the only other film that came out that weekend that I've seen. I don't even think I've heard of any of these other films.
Yeah, so we have Red Scorpion, which is like about a Soviet warrior leading a rebellion against a gang of murderers that killed his family. Sounds badass. It looks like it's kind of Rambo-esque.
Got Dolph Lundgren, you said, right?
It's got Dolph Lundgren. It's very much in that vein. None of us have seen it. I think we should have.
Yeah, sounds like a blind spot for me.
Yeah, get on that. I want to report back.
I'll give you 500 words on it, Paul.
That's your assignment. And then we have like Speed Zone. Speed Zone has John Candy, and it looks like a Cannonball Run. It looks like a ton of the movies we did, Jordan. Death Race 2000. Kind of like one of these car race movies.
Well, you're telling me there's a chance for us to do a John Candy movie and we haven't done it yet?
There's a Death Race-esque movie with fucking John Candy?
Right? This is such a blind spot. This is two blind spots that we have in the same weekend. This is a new side I need to see of John Candy.
Yeah, that looks awesome, right?
You just definitely blew both our minds right
definitely
now.
Definitely throwing that on our list. We'll see. We'll do that within the next year. Then we have See You in the Morning. I've heard about this film. I heard it's really intriguing. I don't know from where, but it's about a Manhattan psychiatrist played by Jeff Bridges who shuttles from his second wife to his ex-wife, whose ex-wife is played by Farrah Fawcett. It's just stacked with like really famous actors today. It's got Drew Barrymore. It's got Lucas Hedges, Macaulay Culkin. You know, it's
like
one
Drew
of those
Barrymore and like Macaulay Culkin, mm-hmm. They're like their childhood star primaries.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. But I don't know much about this movie. I don't even know where I heard it from. So anyways, the last one is Teen Witch. Never heard about this one. Anyone? I thought, oh, Teen Wolf came out this weekend. And then no, not Teen Wolf. High School Nerd Luis, played by Robin Lively. I don't even know that actress. Learns from psychic Madame Serena that she's possessed with magical abilities that will begin working on her 16th birthday. It sounds
like Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
A little bit.
Just without the talking cat and the weird aunts.
So anyways, because we've only seen one out of all of us, we're not going to really tackle these or even pick one to choose for our movie ticket. We just have too little to go on. But Jed, about Pet Sematary, have you seen it recently? Do you remember seeing it? Do you remember anything from that version?
So I haven't watched Pet Sematary recently. The only thing that I really remember about Pet Sematary, it's one of those movies that you watch, or at least I watched, and it kind of just washed over me. And I've forgotten just about everything except for the really hammy performance of the guy that says things like, oh, we bury our dead there, Don. Like, it's this really like hillbilly meets Jimmy Stewart type vernacular like that he's speaking in, and he's like, oh, it's haunted over there, we gotta bury the dog and the dog will come back, like, and it's a really fun voice, and that's all I remember. And also the kid getting run over, like, spoiler alert, but there's child death in that movie. Kind of hard to forget a movie having child death, and yet I forgot most of the movie. I want to wrap back to Speed Zone for a second, though, if you guys don't mind, because
absolutely, it's still on my mind.
Listen, it's not just John Candy. I feel like we did a disservice here. This movie has Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, and Don Lake, all from SCTV, as well as Matt Frewer, aka Max Headroom, fucking Tim Matheson. It has Dick and Tom Smothers, Alyssa Milano, Brooke Shields, Lee Van Cleef, Art Hindle. Like, this is insane. And in some countries, it was released as Cannonball Run 3.
Oh, whoa. Okay.
It won. No, it was nominated for 3 Razzies, apparently. And Brooke Shields won Worst Supporting Actress. And I don't care. I need to see this movie.
Yeah.
This sounds really fun.
I mean, Speed Zone has such a stacked cast. That sounds amazing. And I love any film that's up for the Razzies because you know it's pretty good. Like, you know it's going to be quality. It's memorable. It's got something that's indelible about it. And the plot, like, is interesting in the sense that there's, like, a twist on the death race, right? It's, like, I think from, like, the perspective, I think John Candy plays a police chief who's trying to halt this coast-to-coast race. His, like, attempts keep being thwarted and failing when inexperienced drivers sit in for the pros instead. So, I don't know. It sounds kind of like a weird subversion of the genre because we dove so deeply into it.
Yeah.
Right.
Of like that 10th point I'm down to see is like the perspective of the peace officer in this weird fascist proto-capitalist society.
It's got probably that bumbling cop late 80s narrative. The joke's on him and it's a farce. And I think John Candy plays that really well. For the other movies that are in theaters, we're going to pick our movie ticket. I guess we can pick for any of the ones which just opened. At least we can pick it for, for Speed Zone or Red Scorpion, right? Because those are legitimate interests now. But so if we're going to see one movie, we have, I guess it was $5 in the 90s. Let's make it $3 in the late 80s to see that Saturday matinee. Which one would we go to? And we got Major League, one of the more hilarious sports films of all time, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. We have the tongue-in-cheek satire, Heathers. Has anyone seen Heathers recently?
No, I've never seen that, actually.
Yes, I have. And recently, for that matter, I bought the steelbook when it went on sale at Barnes & Noble. Very beautiful steelbook. And the transfer looks great. And it holds up. It's a film that I was fully expecting to have aged poorly because I remembered certain aspects of that film being something that's like, I don't know, like, is that going to be funny in 2023? And it is. That movie's funny as fuck. It's so good. Because Jordan, you've never seen it, right?
Yeah, I'm just looking up the synopsis right now. But yeah, break it down.
Yeah, so I mean, Heathers is at its core, it's a film about violence in high school, right? I mean, it's Winona Ryder and Christian Slater back when they were like teen heartthrobs. And the easiest way to describe the film is think a venomous version of Mean Girls. And Mean Girls is already a pretty venomous movie as it is. Like, Heathers is, it borders on being cruel at times. It doesn't lean into exploitative territory. It's not like, you know, you're watching something that Vinegar Syndrome would put out on, you know, 4K UHD or anything. It's still, however, shockingly mean-spirited for what is ostensibly a teen movie. But it always manages to soften the blow with the humor of it without even being too bad. I don't know. Like, I don't really know what else to say. I wasn't prepared to talk about Heathers. The point I'm getting at is that Heathers is good. And that's my pick, like, even before Paul finishes the list, because I liked it way more than I was expecting to in 2023.
Yeah, I love Heathers. I just watched Due Revenge maybe 4 or 5 months ago on Netflix. I don't know if you caught that one, but it's definitely a solid update on Heathers, in my opinion. Like, a lot of films have been trying to capture the Heathers magic, and I actually thought Due Revenge did a damn good job at it. It's one of the few films that feels like it's made for the Netflix algorithm, but it's definitely above that. There's some energy to that film. There's some sass. My Hawk's great in it. I liked Austin Abrams. I like him from Euphoria. So, like, it's a young cast, but it's definitely on the top of my mind recently because of that film. I saw it maybe 7 or 8 years ago. I'm talking about Heathers, and it was like my wife's, one of her teenage favorites. And it's great. It's just so dark, unapologetically dark. The cast is just so good. Christian Slater, everyone that you mentioned, fucking awesome.
I mean, there's a bit in that movie, and it was one of the bits that I was afraid was not going to age well, because there's the homophobic jocks, and they're constantly calling Christian Slater's character like homophobic slurs, and, you know, they're just like doing really blatantly homoerotic things. And so a running gag in the movie, Jordan, is that Christian Slater will basically just like kill somebody and then stage it as a suicide because they want like suicide to look cool. And so what ends up happening is he kills the homophobic jocks and stages it as if it was a murder suicide in which they were gay lovers. Like, the suicide note like says like, you know, I'm in love, blah, blah, blah. The thing is that makes it funny, but also kind of touching, is that like the homophobic jock's dad is also homophobic, but at his funeral, he gives this really like teary, heartfelt speech about how he loves and supports his son. And he ends it with a line that cracks me up every time. It's a quote, "I love my dead gay son."
Every time.
It's so fucking good. Heather's is, it's baller.
It's a good delivery of it too.
All right, let's keep going. We got Twins. Jordan, I know you love Twins. I love Twins. Yeah. Schwarzenegger comedy with Danny DeVito. They're separated at birth.
One of the better Schwarzenegger movies. One of the underappreciated Schwarzenegger movies for sure.
Yeah, how many times have you seen this, would you guess?
Oh, man. Like, that's the thing. All these 89 movies are like ones that I just wore out in VHS. Like, wore out, and then I tape them again when they're on HBO, and then I'd wear those VHSs out again. Twins was definitely one of those. Yeah, I've seen that one a lot. I was going to say, I wouldn't pick Twins for mine. Actually, you already mentioned that the one I would pick, and it's for kind of a weird reason. Like, you said Major League, and I've only seen Major League 2. I've never seen the first Major League. I just brought this up the other day with my fiance. We were watching Newfound Glory. We saw their acoustic set in Garden Grove, and Ian has a really cool decked out bass with all Major League logo and everything. Charlie Sheen, really cool like bass design. And he got me thinking, I was like, I've never seen that movie. I've seen the second one, like the second one, never watched the first one. So just one of those weird things I tend to do where I start with a sequel sometimes. And I'm like, yeah, I'd go check that out in the theater. Hell yeah. So I think I'd give my ticket to that one, Major League.
We got two already. We're going so quick this time compared to last time. Twins for me is up there. I want to keep it alive a little longer, but it's been a while since I saw it. And I love Danny DeVito as this kind of like hustler figure. I don't know. I like the juxtaposition and the buddy comedy element with them.
Road trip thing going on too.
Yeah. We've been talking about Arnold so much on this, like Kindergarten Cop era Arnold. And I still remember watching Twins with my family in the 90s on VHS a bunch. So it's really nostalgic for me as well for that reason. But I want to just bring up a few more before I pick, at least, to keep some suspense going. We have Rain Man, which I actually watched during the pandemic. I remember like maybe 2 years ago. Solid film. I really enjoyed how unlikable, like really fucking unlikable Tom Cruise's character is in this film.
Such an asshole in that movie. Yeah.
He's such an asshole, not to be too woke, but like borderline ableist, right? Like he's just so rude and insulting to Dustin Hoffman. Though I didn't love Dustin Hoffman's performance as much, I think it won the Academy Award, of course, because this was the era where if you played anyone like on the spectrum or anyone, you know,
it was a lock.
Yeah, it was a lock, right? He might have lost though, because I know that My Left Foot was up. Did Daniel Day-Lewis win? I'm not sure, but it's like the only thing that could beat it is a paraplegic. I say that in a very cynical way. But it was solid. It was a solid road trip film. Actually held up better than I thought it would. Then we have Say Anything, Cameron Crowe film. I was just on Callous Pod doing Almost Famous, and we talked about Say Anything quite a bit. I love Cameron Crowe. I mean, this is pretty much one of his breakout films. I know he wrote Fast Times at Ridgemont High before this, but I think this is like his first writing and directing super breakout movie. And John Cusack set him up, you know, as our like cool indie music guy, kind of, that would play into a lot of his roles in the 90s. All the iconic scenes. It influenced one of our favorite band's names. To be honest, I haven't seen this one in a good second. Anyone have fond memories of Say Anything? Or does anyone really still love and champion this movie?
I was never a big fan of it, to be honest. I kind of watched it obligatory because, like you said, Say Anything. Got to know where the title came from the band. I'm not a big John Cusack fan, I think, though. I think I need to go back now as like older and rewatch his stuff. I feel like I glance over a lot of that stuff. Like, what's that one with him and Jack Black?
High Fidelity?
Yeah. Like one of those ones I've seen and have like no memory of, and I kind of want to go back. I know it's like essential of him. So he's one I feel like I haven't given a fair shake.
Man, we are far on that spectrum. I love High Fidelity and Say Anything. Well, I might not pick it. Oh, I love it as well. Like it is just a great coming of age 80s romance high school film that finishes off with such an iconic scene. But people, I think, over fixate on that and forget that like the whole film is so strong. The characters are so strong. I mean, Cameron Crowe is like one of our best. He's a sentimentalist, but he's not cloying. And I think that's really interesting because we're trying to set the scene for, you know, what's going to be our topic of the day, Field of Dreams. And I don't want to get into it yet, but it'll be interesting to think about, I think, in my mind, Say Anything, like in that kind of sentimentality versus Field of Dreams and its type of sentimentality. Yeah. They're very different. Their tones aren't even trying to do the same thing, but I think they are both very of the 80s in a very different way. Jed, how about you and Say Anything?
I think Say Anything is a very good movie. It's been quite a few years since I've watched it, but I was just in the same state as you, Paul, like for a wedding. And the guy who got married, one of his favorite movies in high school was Say Anything. And I had never seen it. So he showed me that and Better Off Dead in the same weekend. And I didn't like Better Off Dead. I get why people have a fondness for it. It's, you know, kind of a memeable movie before memes were a thing. Has that I want my $2 line. But Say Anything has this really kind of melancholy young love fixation that's pretty sweet, honestly. And I mean, it all came full circle too, because fun fact, at his wedding, their last dance was In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel, which is the song from the famous scene where he holds the boombox outside of her window, which, you know, if we're tying this back to like emo bands we listened to in high school, is referenced in that Hawthorne Heights song.
Mm-hmm. Radio. One of the best. Nikki FM, I believe, right? Is it Nikki FM? So. Yeah.
I think, Paul, also, we were talking about High Fidelity for a second, and I think that that has, in the same kind of like, it might be a stretch, but it makes sense to me kind of way, it has a little bit to do with what we're talking about with Field of Dreams too, because High Fidelity is one of the perfect examples in my mind of a bait and switch movie. It's the type of film that I feel has a misunderstanding fanhood behind it, right? And so what I mean by that is there are people who watch High Fidelity and they see themselves in these characters, in these like douchebag dudes who run a fucking record store and judge people off of what they like versus what they are like. The thing is that High Fidelity, kind of the book and the film, have this like nice balancing act where, like, yeah, of course, the first half of the movie tips towards like, these are your characters, you know, like them, and this is what they're like, before slowly revealing like, you really shouldn't like these guys because they don't even like themselves. They have a lot of room for improvement. And I think that Field of Dreams, in a weird kind of way, it doesn't present its characters as people that you should dislike in any way as it goes on. I would argue, and I'm not going to give away my hand too much, Paul, you know a little bit about this, I would argue that as the film goes on, it does, if you're paying attention, become harder to justify some of the actions of the characters in Field of Dreams in a rational sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll get into that. It's very much veering into pure magical realism and surrealism on every level, right? I mean, if from the very get-go, right, like 2 minutes in, he's hearing voices in a very magical cinematic way. And you know, it's a little bit off its rocker, you know, it's close to like a Christian parable, if you want to look at it in one way, but then it gets even weirder and weirder and more existential. And that's a good thing, but also a little more twee. And that's where I think we'll have some really interesting discussions. But what you said about High Fidelity is really interesting, because I've been thinking a lot about Philip Seymour Hoffman's role in Almost Famous since I recently tackled that. And I feel like that and High Fidelity are like spiritual siblings, that role and that film. And I get exactly what you're saying. It's like an unlikable character, but a character with like extreme taste. It's also very charismatic. And it's interesting the way the discourse, or just like the way today interacts with those characters and how they age. I was a little surprised to hear some of the readings of Philip Seymour Hoffman in Almost Famous as being just strictly bitter, where I absolutely adored him in every sense. But I mean, that's probably a little reflexive and a little like almost narcissistic, because I think I relate and have an affinity for those types of characters. But there's also a heavy hitter this weekend or this box office period for great auteurs. I mean, more box office-y ones, right? But I mentioned Cameron Crowe. We also have Ivan Reitman, right, who made Twins this weekend, right? And we have Barry Levinson, who made Rain Man. Barry Levinson is someone who I recently really fell in love with. I know his son is one of the most polarizing figures out there, period, today, Sam Levinson. But I mean, Diner, seminal film. And I saw Rain Man through the lens of it being a Barry Levinson film. And Twins is interesting too, because I mean, Ivan Reitman, he made Draft Day. You know, he's coming off the 80s where he did Ghostbusters. Did he just pass away right after? I think he was working on the reboots for the Ghostbusters, but I believe he just passed away.
Ivan Reitman passed away in 2022. Yeah, just last year. And I think that was right before the Ghostbusters Afterlife movie, right? Oh, wow. I didn't know this. He actually acts in it. Did you guys know this?
I haven't seen it, actually.
There's a sequence that has Harold Ramis in it. Harold Ramis having been dead for many years. So he's kind of deep faked into it. Ivan Reitman did the mocap for it. And so they put Harold Ramis's likeness over him.
And Reitman is also the brainchild behind all of those Schwarzenegger films that I was talking about, like his stretch of comedies from the late 80s or early 90s. He directed not only Twins, but he also did Junior and Kindergarten Cop. Yeah. So I'm picking Twins. I'm going back with Twins. I want a good laugh. I want a nice, like, posthumous celebration of his work. I think he's completely underrated because he kind of worked more in comedy, right? And comedy's not so highbrow. But I mean, he had such a steady, long-going career. He produced Space Jam, which we know is just like commercial fluffery, but fun. He produced Private Parts, which is really silly movie, right? Animal House, right? He's just like Meatballs, Ghostbusters. I mean, the guy's behind so many seminal American products that have that nostalgic element to them, that he was doing something right. And so I would be curious to see something like Twins, like a comedy that as dated as that on the big screen. I would like to see it with a packed house too. It'd be fun to be in a theater with people from the 80s. That'd be such a weird experience, right? To go back in time and like have the sensibility of that time period. Like imagine watching a Frank Capra film at that time period with those people from that period.
I think about this all the time, Paul, and I'm not going to derail the podcast with this, but like, as you know, one sentence, I'll say this, like I've been in the process of challenging myself to watch every Douglas Sirk film that was ever made from the early 1930s through his final film in 1959, 37 films in total. And those films were very much misunderstood at the time. Not even a decade later, all it took, just like many films that were misunderstood, were the French to come out and say, actually, you Americans are stupid. And these films are biting social satires. And suddenly it's like, oh, what the fuck? I love The Searchers. Like, or with Douglas Sirk's case, it's, you know, Written on the Wind is a masterpiece. All That Heaven Allows is a masterpiece. I would like to go back to 1959 and watch Imitation of Life with a 1959 era crowd and see what they would have to say about it. Just the same as I would love to go back to 1989 to the premiere of Twins or even another film that came out that year, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Oh, yeah.
Today's film, Field of Dreams.
Yeah, I mean, that is our segue. I mean, seeing how that rubbed off on me, sitting in a screening of Field of Dreams at like the premiere or just like I said, a packed house on opening weekend. For a lot of these films, I can imagine it more, right? This is such a heavy hitting year. I know, Jed, right before we started, you were listing off all the bangers this year, right? And it's just like packed with so many films that still echo and resonate today in the discourse and the conversation of movie lovers.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, so there's a famous story about the movie UHF, Weird Al's only movie. Well, and you know, the only movie that Weird Al ever made that he starred in. And the famous anecdote is that the studio put out UHF and they put it out against basically every film that I'm about to name, because the highest grossing films of 1989 in order are Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Batman, Back to the Future 2, Look Who's Talking, Dead Poets Society, The Little Mermaid, Lethal Weapon 2, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Ghostbusters 2, and fucking Born on the 4th of July. Like, almost all of those were in theaters that summer, and UHF had to open against that. Of course it fucking bombed.
Yeah, and of course, though, like, for me, I would rather see UHF, if we had to say, above all those in a theater today. I fucking love UHF. I think so good.
Do you remember the first time you saw that, Paul?
Oh, it wasn't until like I ran across it in Korea when I was doing my deep dives. How about you?
Dude, you don't remember watching it at Ivan's house?
No.
I remember one time he didn't have cable. He says, I used to be our drummer in like our high school band. And he didn't have cable and we had to like hang out there for like an afternoon. We couldn't leave. And like, he just had this UHF. I'm like, oh, that's a Weird Al on there. We watched it from beginning to end. We're just captivated by it. It was so fucking funny. Like, made me a Weird Al fan for like life. Like,
if I'm being completely honest, like, because I've known you guys for 20 plus years now, one of the first conversations I ever got in with Irving, your guys' old singer, was about how fucking funny UHF is. So like, that's weird. That's crazy, Paul. Like, I can't believe you don't remember that, because I know for a fact that I've talked to each of you about UHF. Like, when
I feel like we talked about it.
Including you, Paul. We talked about UHF outside of El Dorado. And like, I like made a reference to Conan the Librarian and you started laughing.
That's my problem when I go to these long-term memory things. I have the worst long-term memory. Maybe I saw it twice. Maybe I like rewrote it. But I just remember like going on a second deep dive and watching it again in Korea. and absolutely falling in love with it because it's an homage to eccentric art. Like, it's like this, I mean, yeah, it's all the things you said. It's quirky and funny and filled with all these memorable like quotes, but it's also just like a really powerful film about the resilience of an artist who's like unabashedly idiosyncratic, right? Which is what Weird Al is, but it's so strong at that, right? And I love, yeah, I love that vibe of it.
And I mean, another thing about UHF that's really cool, you're listening to fucking Cinematic Underdogs, the podcast about UHF. Another thing that I really like, and before we move on from UHF, is just the fact that, like, yeah, there's movie parodies and yeah, there are pop culture parodies in that. The best jokes in that movie are the ones that just lean into the surreal, like whether or not it's a pop culture reference that we're so far removed from that it just feels like a non sequitur, or if it just is genuinely a non sequitur. I think a lot about the Spatula City bit, just the entire premise of there being a Costco-sized store that sells nothing but spatulas of different sizes. I mean, that's really funny.
Still holds up.
So good.
It is so, so, so good. And I want to just take a step back real quick because we are talking about Frank Capra, right? And you mentioned Frank Capra films and specifically you call Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams as a modern Frank Capra protagonist, right? And if I'm not mistaken, they even have a direct allusion to It's a Wonderful Life early in the film. Is that It's a Wonderful Life or is that a different film that I'm somehow mistaking? Or
are you talking about In Field of Dreams? So yeah. I'm assuming you'd probably be correct on that.
Jed, did you catch that? Do you know what film they're watching on TV early in the film? I think they're having breakfast or something. It was one of those moments where it was like, directors like to shoehorn in like these winks. They throw something on the TV that like resembles their film or like it's a direct reference or allusion. And I'm not actually sure precisely what film it was, but I read it right away, maybe because I was already getting such It's a Wonderful Life vibes. And this was just like totally authentically off the cuff because I didn't read anything about Field of Dreams before I went into this. Went into this very raw. I did not have almost any memory of seeing this. Three-fourths of the way through, I told my wife, no, I don't think I had actually seen this. It must have just sat on my shelf. My dad might have watched it a bunch around, but I don't know. And then oddly enough, when Gabby Hoffman, the daughter, when she falls off the bench, that like hit a million light bulbs in my brain in the weirdest way. And I was like, oh shit, I've seen this like a bunch of times. I'm the worst long-term movie memory person.
I'm with you on this one though. That was definitely a triggering scene for like, because I was we kind of talked before the pod, like I remember watching this with my dad. And this was like the first time as a kid, I watched a baseball movie and I didn't really like it. I was like, that wasn't like Sandlot. That wasn't like Rookie of the Year. You know, it wasn't like a kid in King Arthur's court. But where's the magic? Like, even though there's a lot of magic in this, but, you know, it was kind of just like, I was like, oh, this is like a God story, I guess. It's my like smart ass take on it. And like, so I was like really stoked to watch this one again, though, because like it was, I always thought it was kind of boring. And like, I get why my dad wanted me to watch this with him, because this is at a time I was a big baseball fan. And that was like our thing, going to baseball games, like Dodger games and stuff like that. But we were really into like baseball stats. And that's like a big part of like, I think that's the thing he actually liked about it. Because I really don't think he was like a big fan of this movie. It wasn't like one he'd go back to. But I do remember this is like one of those ones he actually like intentionally tried to sit down and watch with me as like, oh, you like baseball? We can lend this one. It just did not land. And so it's like, I never went back to watch it. And like as a kid, like in my baseball phase, like I used to like, what's that one with Tom Selleck where he goes to Japan?
That's Mr. Baseball.
Yeah, Mr. Baseball. Even that one, I was like, as a kid, I love that movie. But like, that was such a dad movie too. But like Field of Dreams just didn't land with me. So like, kind of like you, Paul, I was like, I've seen it, but like that part where she falls, like the kid was very memorable for me, I guess, as a kid. It kind of sparked a lot of like memories. Like, oh, I do remember some of this.
See, I think for me, so I watched this movie relatively recently. When I watched it, I was under the impression that I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. And when I turned it on, there were so many aspects of the film that I instantly recognized because this film became part of the pop culture in a huge way. I mean, if you watched The Simpsons, if you watched the show The Critic, if you watched, I mean, South Park, any comedy movie that was made between the 90s and the 2000s, there was some kind of reference to Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. Even just you know, the general obsession, even the whole the sight gag that you see in a lot of things where it's like a baseball diamond on the edge of a cornfield and like fucking a ghost walking out of it, you see that and you instantly in your head go Field of Dreams. When I watched this, though, I was like, have I seen this? I didn't remember anything beyond those pop culture touchstones. And so my experience rewatching this was so much different than I expected it to be. And I'll get into that like a little later, because like, I'm curious, Paul, like, what were your experiences like as a kid? I mean, other than just like what you were saying with like the kid crashing down, stuff like that, like what were you expecting going into this movie this time?
Yeah, that's what's interesting is like, it's such a general sentiment I was expecting. And I think I got it from the James Horner score. But there is something very, like I already said, surrealistic about this movie that I wasn't expecting. I knew that there was voices, right? I knew the famous quote, right? Build it, they will come. So much of this has by osmosis ended up in our psyche through, like, as you just said, through pop culture. You know, I knew it was like also this like seminal movie about playing catch with your father, like the most cliche, like bonding, familial, masculine pastime archetype there is. Like, is there anything more father son than playing catch? I don't think so. Tom Cruise does it in War of the Worlds. It's in a million films. It's almost like immemorial for modern history since the invention of baseball, at least. And I knew that it ended with that, but I wasn't expecting it to also be as psychedelic as it was. Like, as a Berkeley graduate, right? And there's all these references early on to Berkeley. I started getting the sense that, this is taking a weird direction. And then they like bring up an acid trip playfully at the kitchen table in front of their daughter, nonetheless, right? Like having an acid flashback. And then he's like rocking a Berkeley shirt. They're like loosely quoting a ton of like, you know, 60s aphorisms and, you know, tune in, drop out, those types of things. Yeah. And so it's very much also steeped in that like late 60s, free love, everything is connected, new age hippieisms. And I was like, this is bizarre. I did not expect it to blend like the most Americana, almost blue collar entity, baseball, cornfields, Iowa, with its liberal leftist West Coast aesthetic and ethos and identity. And that conflation or that combination, I thought, delivered an intriguing result or mixture of elements for me. Like a lot of this was like weird personal, associations I was having. Like I took a class called Existentialism in Film and Literature. And like, I feel like everyone in that class was in a very like hipster faux way, obsessed with like this pastoral idealism. Everyone like wanted to be that that resurgent everyman or like handyman type, right? Like this was like the hip way of being an existentialist at the time. It was so cool to have the dream to like be a potato farmer on, to just like get back to the roots, to like feel the soil in your fingers. And those platitudes, I don't want to say that in such a critical sense, but like that type of sensibility, right? This sort of Elysian Fields mentality of like the proletarian Marxist way, the way of the earth is like the farmer's way, the agrarian lifestyle.
Sorry, but I cut you off because like I'm going to add to this because you mentioned the big identifier. He's an English major from Berkeley. So like he checks all those things you say. It's all the stuff he's read about. Just like you said, all the ideas of Emersonian self-reliance, right? The big American figurehead of all that shit, right? But this movie is literally him like never doing any of that stuff, right? So I'm glad you brought that up because that was my first thought. I was like this dude's from Berkeley. I like the idea that he's just like planted here, but a lot of the movie is just him not wanting to work on a fucking farm. That really funny because we read about this stuff, like you said, like I used to love Emerson back in the day, but reading him as like a 30-year-old, I'm like, nah, it doesn't fly anymore. But here's him as a 30-year-old kind of still like grasping onto that. It's just this like continuing theme of him grasping on to these really overarching themes or sentimentalities of childhood and these Renaissance movements, be it baseball or like the college movement, the hippie movement. And he just like romanticizes it, right? And it's just him like really like reaching for the next one, which I'm glad you brought that up because I love the, like you said, the setting in which it's kind of arises from. They're super romantic and their relationship is the stuff of romance books, right? The stuff of college love. And like you said, they end up in this pastoral setting, but they don't really know what to like do with it. And even in that, they still like kind of like wave that flag of like neoliberalism, like that great scene with the, we'll get later to like the book banning, right? But I love it. Like no matter what they do, even like these like Americana sense, they're still bringing all that New York stuff where he was raised, Berkeley, where he's educated, to Iowa. But I'm like my whole question is like, where did he get the skills to farm in any of this stuff? His dad was like his hardcore worker in New York, you know? So I was like, I like the whole setup of it all. It has all these like just meandering themes of just, like you said, all sorts of American icons, like the working class American, the intellectual American, the bootstrap American, all that somehow is like just meshed into this story. We'll get into like how it plays out. But I was intrigued by that from the beginning. I was like, this is a little more layered, like you said, than I remember it being. There's a lot more going on here.
Yeah, Field of Dreams is very interesting in that regard. I mean, it's a film that has more to say in the peripherals than it appears to be saying in front of you at any given moment. One of my favorite things about Field of Dreams is that, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a James Horner score, right? Mm-hmm. So that score does a lot of heavy lifting towards making this like a dad movie classic. Like, you hear that score and it gives you the vibe exactly as you need it. Mm-hmm. However, if you were to replace that score with any other score, like let's just say, for instance, that you have Johan Johansson, right? Like, or you have a Hans Zimmer type, and you go for something slightly less sentimental, this film also can be read as quite sinister in a way. And I think that it's one of the interesting things about Field of Dreams is that it's proof positive that the way a film is scored can really make a difference in the story being told, because it's either man hears voices in his head and decides to build a baseball diamond on his farm, or man hears voices in his head, decides to build a baseball diamond on his farm, and basically creates a cult that manages to eventually kill a famous former civil rights leader.
So like, I'm glad you went there. I was like, there's so many horror stories that could arise of this concept. Like, why is this never taken to the next sport with like this weird afterlife where you just go to hell or whatever and then you got to come back? Sorry, I was about to go on tangent there.
No, it's cool. And like, the thing about it is too, is that if this were the only thing that I had seen from Phil Alden Robinson, the guy who directed and wrote this, then I would think like, okay, maybe I'm just imagining this. This is just, you know, Phil Alden Robinson just, you know, has like some weird tonal stuff going on. But this man created the show. He co-created the show, The Good Fight. Now, I don't know if you guys have ever seen The Good Fight, but The Good Fight also does something similar here in that it uses a lot of familiar iconography, specifically with the idea of the lawyer show, a semi-serialized show that is a spinoff of another lawyer show called The Good Wife. And it stars Christine Baranski as a lawyer who lost all of her fortune in a Ponzi scheme. And she loses her space as a named partner at a law firm. And she ends up as like a rich white liberal woman having to kind of, you know, reestablish herself in an all black law firm. And so it's like kind of like a sitcom type premise, but it's a very serious show that also leans on purpose heavily into the surreal, because the other premise of the show is that Donald Trump has just been elected president. The show starts in 2016 on election night. And she, the good liberal that she is, throughout all of The Good Wife, one of her defining character traits is Hillary Clinton. I am a Hillary Clinton fan. Like, she has a picture of Hillary Clinton on her fucking desk. She loses her mind a little. It's like a really, it ends up being a really good statement for that idea of, you know, the left-leaning, well-natured people who lost their minds when the election happened. And the surrealism of the show reflects that in a huge way. Watching that show and seeing things like Christine Baranski microdosing and fucking, you know, weird things are happening where, you know, Twitter is getting hacked by strange hackers. And like, there's a kangaroo court that gets formed in the back of a fucking copy shop. Like, it's just all this crazy shit keeps happening while still hitting the beats of what you expect out of a lawyer show. That now I look back at this film, Field of Dreams, retroactively, and I think that maybe this is what Phil Alden Robinson has been doing all along, is he's taking the familiar, kind of warping it and making it so you can enjoy what he's putting out on a surface level, lizard brain level. Or you can look a little deeper and see that he has something really fucking weird that he has to say.
Mm-hmm. That's totally fair.
Yeah, that's very fair. And that reminds me of like you bringing up already like Douglas Sirk and the French, like sort of getting underneath the veneer of a film like that. I think a Frank Capra film, like It's a Wonderful Life, we've all kind of taken as a deep metaphysical film.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to hear sort of your two cents as you're doing this deep dive with like Douglas Sirk, and you could bring in Frank Capra too, like more like 30s, 40s cinema. How this is an interesting reinvention or continuation of that tradition, right? That's what I think about Field of Dreams probably the most, is that it's this extremely palatable and anodyne, like it's harmless film. It's very innocuous. It's not like you mentioned, I think earlier, like there's no bad characters in this. There's no cynicism in this, except for maybe the realtor brother, but he has a great redemption arc at the very end. You know, you had to have some suspense, I guess. but it has this wistful, quixotic, like idealistic impression of the American family, of relating and remembering our ancestors, actually, our lineage, of reconnecting after death with, you know, a father figure, and finding some sort of personal penitence and salvation and forgiveness, right? Because there is some deep undertones here. And I think that's why this is considered, you know, the film that makes men cry. Like, that's one of the things this is known for, especially right from that last line from Costner. I wish I knew it verbatim on the top of my head, but when whatever he says to ask his father to play catch again, when he says that, he sells it to the max degree, right?
It's just quiver.
The right quiver.
All he says is, "Dad, you want to have a catch."
Dad, you want to have
a catch. I didn't deliver it with Costner S, but yeah, he does that kind of like a quiver. It's like the first time he calls him dad, right? Because he introduces him to like his wife and child as like John, or you know, whatever his surname is.
I thought that was so interesting. I don't want to go too far because I was trying to get into a question for Jed about Douglas Sirk and Capra. But I also do want to mention that that's so interesting. And I thought, how bizarre that his father shows up and that he's trying to somehow cover the facade or make this transaction very impersonal. The interplay of fiction or of imagination or the supernatural, right? The unreal and the real here. There's a lot of bizarre things. And at the end, like, it's very fanciful. You could only almost say that it's just purely magical realism in the sense of like whatever works for the story goes. And I'm not saying this in a negative sense, but every decision then has meaning in its own weird space, in its own context. And so like, why does everyone think at some point, I want to ask, does he not refer to his father as father right away when his father shows up again? So that's a question I want to just throw out there for people to think and maybe touch upon. Before that though, Jed, about this Douglas Sirk, did you see any connections between this film and those films?
Sirk, no. So the thing about this movie is through and through the closest thing that you'll get to a modern, and when I say modern, I mean of the era that it came out, recreation of a Frank Capra type movie. Now, It can be a bit of a thin line sometimes between Frank Capra and Douglas Sirk, but the biggest difference between the two is that Frank Capra very much loved America and what America represented. And Douglas Sirk loved America, but was deeply skeptical of what America represented. In particular, of the era he was making films, he was very skeptical of the nuclear family. He was skeptical of suburbia. He was skeptical of keeping things up for the appearances. That's a common theme in Douglas Sirk films. On the other hand, Frank Capra isn't quite as skeptical about those things. Frank Capra is more curious about how somebody can basically attain the unattainable, right? I mean, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or It's a Wonderful Life, we keep coming back to. It's this idea of a man. That movie's so fucking depressing. I need to say that for a second. I don't know how recently you guys have watched it, but It's a Wonderful Life.
Sorry to cut you up. I've never seen it. To me, it's like Field of Dreams through a pop culture.
It's a Wonderful Life is literally about a man who's at like the end of his rope. Like, Jimmy Stewart's about to fucking kill himself. Like, that film is overtly about a man who's about to commit suicide because he feels like he has nothing left to live for. And then he's shown what life would be like if he never existed. And it's, you know, popular trope. It's been shown, it's been done to death. Beavis and Butthead did a really funny parody of it, I'm sure you guys remember, where it's like how awesome life would be if Butthead never lived. But like, that movie's really sad. And that's kind of the same thing with Field of Dreams. And it's why I think it's Capra-esque and not Sirk-esque. These are both deeply sad films about deeply broken people that are trying to find meaning in something that is ultimately out of their control in a normal sense. But in, as Paul put it, a magical realism sense, this is a story that can be controlled and you can get somewhat of a happy ending from these kinds of storytelling circumstances. It's almost like a Deus Ex Machina in a way, except the whole story functions and hinges off of that. So to kind of just wrap back to what you were saying, Paul, I don't think it's Sirk-esque. This film doesn't really have a cynical bone in its body. Like, the cynical things that are being said in this movie aren't about the main characters or what they represent. And in a Sirk film, Sirk doesn't fucking trust his people.
Absolutely. Sticking though with this Frank Capra connection, right? The key Frank Capra actor was James Stewart. And I want to talk about how Costner plays his role. That was one thing that really, I think, kept me, the whole film, very entranced when I was watching Field of Dreams. I think he plays this in a unique way. He's actually very subdued. He's very low-key, kind of melancholic, and kind of understated throughout. There's a wariness to him. There's a beleaguered quality to him. And for such an iconic role, I guess maybe it's just more has to do with the intersection of my expectations and what the film was. I was expecting something more cloying, something a little bit more syrupy. And I got that from a lot of parts. But even Jordan, like you mentioned, the quivering in his voice, I thought that like he sold that completely. And as someone who watched this in a very schizoid way, in the sense that like I was on board and off board, I was cynical and I was sold. That line still got me, and I was suddenly choked up. And like I just moments earlier, I was, I think, completely on the other end of that spectrum. Just a testament, I think, to Costner's prowess, just what he represents. And I always think of him as such an underrated. I know, I get that he's so iconic and so forth. But for some reason, I don't know why I think this, I think that he's still underrated to this day. Like, we don't really respect Kevin Costner as one of the great actors of our entire generation.
Like, yeah, I want to take the other side. I like him, but I'm never really sold by Kevin Costner because sometimes he's too understated. I always think of like Dances with Wolves. All I remember is he's got a good flow, great flow in that movie. His hair is awesome. But like, and even like Draft Day, a movie I like him in that one, but like, he never really like wows me. I feel like, and like this one, like he does deliver, I think, on the comedy. I feel like when he meets up with James Earl Jones, I love their like back and forth. To me, that's when I'm kind of start liking him a little more. I'm like, yeah, like you said earlier, there's a lot of back and forth for me on this one. And a lot of it started with, I hate when Kevin Costner does a voiceover. And it's just a stupid personal thing. It sounds like he's just reading, and it just bugs me. It's like the kid in the class who just can't read very well. But he's a good actor. But this one started with that damn voiceover. So like I had such a bad bias. I acknowledge that. It just threw back to that commercial he has going on right now. I'm like, really? Another voiceover? But like you said, Paul, there's some parts that like catch me. Like you said, the quiver, there's some delivery there. The part where he tries to hold up James Earl Jones, which is like is everywhere and had me like laughing. And like, I love his like eagerness there. So like, I get you. I'm struggle with this one. He's an actor I struggle with anyways, though. So I'm kind of with you on that. It's a tug and pull. But this one, unfortunately, started with the one thing I don't like about him is his voice. That's just like a dumb personal critique, though.
I am coming from a place where in our house, and by our, I'm referring to myself and my fiance, Sarah, we are honestly unapologetic Kevin Costner fans. It started as a bit of a running joke where we started calling him our Lord and Savior. Every time he would pop up in a film, we'd be like, oh, praise God, like it's him. And we had a phase where we were seeking out different Kevin Costner films, and we did a pretty crazy, substantial Kevin Costner binge. I mean, just like off the top of my head, like we watched Fandango, we watched The Untouchables, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, I watched 3,000 Miles to Graceland, which is bad. I don't care what anybody says. We watched Open Range, The Postman, Waterworld. Like, I mean, and that was just from that binge. I mean, so the thing with like Kevin Costner is that I am with Paul in this. I think Kevin Costner is very much underrated in a weird way. Like, and that's such a weird thing to say about someone who was like the top box office star in the world in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I think it's because everybody has two ideas of who Kevin Costner is. And there's a third idea I'll get to, but like the two main ideas are they either think of him as a washed up has-been who, you know, bombed a ton of careers with the 1-2 punch of Waterworld and The Postman, or they think of him in terms of some of his more romantic roles. And when I say romantic, I'm talking about like this or The Bodyguard, different levels of romanticism. The third type of person with Kevin Costner are, you know, the people that watch Yellowstone, who know modern Kevin Costner and know like, no, the man has kept working. He's still a huge fucking star. Like, It's just that, you know, and Paul, I know you know what I'm talking about. Like, Yellowstone is one of those shows that is one of the most watched shows in America that nobody on film Twitter talks about, except to say that, you know, nobody talks about it, right? Like, I've never seen Yellowstone, and I'm a pretty big Kevin Costner fan. I don't know why I haven't gotten around to it, but I like Kevin Costner. I like him in this film. I think that he is miscast in some things, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves being like the prime example.
Oh, man, I love Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
So do I. That's a
good example because I like all the side characters in that movie.
Yeah.
It's one of those weird childhood movies, like we're talking VHS ones that I just watched because I'm a big Robin Hood, like the story fan. And that was just like the one around when I was young.
That movie fucking slaps. And like, I'm also a pretty big fan of Kevin Reynolds, the director of that film, which like, that's a whole separate thing. This is a Field of Dreams episode. So like, I won't spend too much time on the Kevin Reynolds thing, but like, that was Kevin Costner's go-to director in the late 80s and early 90s. He directed Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, but like, he also did Waterworld with him. And Kevin Reynolds, without Kevin Costner, later did The Count of Monte Cristo with Jim Caviezel and fucking Guy Pearce. And I love Kevin Reynolds like so much. And the partnership between him and Kevin Costner dissolving in the mid-90s was like the Beatles breaking up for me. Like, they'd made just like the perfect combination of like, Jordan, the types of films you're talking about that I like broke the fucking tape on the VHS when I was a kid. Just that type of hand to heart, capital S sincere adventure movie. Like, make a million of those and just fucking mainline them into me. Like, I'll just shoot them up like heroin. Like,
I'm with you there. We need a party like that.
Fucking do it. Let's do some Kevin heroin.
I want to add a fourth or a fifth category though to your Kevin Costner's roles, archetypes in our pop culture. Mm-hmm. He's also, as you put in your Letterboxd review, the king of the dad movie. And I would put slash sports movie. He is the king of the sports movie. No one does more big sports movies than Kevin Costner. I would challenge someone to bring up an actor who's been in more major roles as iconic as Kevin Costner in this genre.
We're getting close to it with Tom Cruise as we do this show. I'm starting to realize that.
But all of his are so peripheral, though. Yeah. But I'll give you that, right? You know, we just did The Color of Money. Excellent, right? Days of Thunder.
If Jerry we're doing Maguire. But that's close. Yeah, keep going though. Like, yeah.
But also, you put that like in this movie, there's a silent intelligence to his everyman characteristics, right? And I think that goes a lot with what we were saying, right? That he has to sell this very hard duality, and that he's post-60s ex-acid head now living in Iowa with his family in this very like pastoral white picket fence farm, corn farm. It's a tough role to sell, but you also put that he doesn't always feel like not only the smartest person in the room, but also the kindest. And that's also what I was trying to say, is he's so tender. There's something so gentle about him in this film. And this film is like a solve. And that's why it's so memorable. And that's why it's stood the test of time. I think this is what dads put on when they want to feel butterflies in their stomach on a Sunday afternoon. Like, there is no film that just hits like those perfect, very almost like monotone good vibes. And this, like, it's such a smooth ride. And it's that James Horner score that comes again and again. And it's always initiated. I noticed this by like a thunder boom and some chimes and a little piano crescendoing. And then you get the score. And then it's so whimsical and magical again. And as you put as well, right? Like, take that out. Just take that score out, right? We have a weird horror movie, right? We have a weird metaphysical treatise on feeling almost suffocated as well by the decisions you've made, by like this life that you almost can't sustain, right? As Jordan, you noted, like, he doesn't want to be out in the cornfields. And I think that that's kind of part of this story, is he doesn't want to be out in the cornfields. I guess my knock a little bit, though, on the other hand, is that it's a very circuitous and roundabout way that this film needs to meander. And I get it, the process is the journey, blah, blah, blah. But like, all this to learn, like, oh, we have a tourist attraction. We have a SeaWorld, right?
We have what we call modern sports, where you come to a place to watch a team play. And that's what they're going to sell, which is a very hard one with the way the movie's aged, which is it aged like based on nostalgia, because it's still part of like, sorry, but going on a tangent, but like, it's been incorporated by sport now. By the MLB, by the NHL, like, you know, the Bruins and the Penguins came out to the Outdoor Classic this year, you know, with the homage, like, they play catch. It's like, you do the runs with it now, but like, it became like more of like a product, right? And that's like the Eureka moment, right? And that's already what it was even then. That's, you know, the World Series getting thrown. So it's kind of like I said, it's a really big roundabout way of coming at this, you know, pretty simple conclusion.
It is, but I would also argue that, I mean, just to really run with the horror thing for a second, to kind of preface this, you have this idea, and I really like what both of you guys are saying about this idea of him as like a vulnerable everyman. One of the things I think is interesting about Kevin Costner in particular is he represents the type of masculine man who does not exist anymore and frankly may never have existed in the first place. He is Kevin Costner. a famously somewhat liberal person, you know, votes for Democrats, endorses Democrats. He is somebody who always talks about leading with kindness, and yet he's always playing these salt of the earth, corn fed, you know, just everyman, these leaders of men, right? These, you know, people who can lead in silence, but still just, you know, make the most of every word that they throw out there. Now, if we look at it as a horror movie and we have that type of person at the head of a horror movie, what I've just described is the ideal leader of a cult. And we have somebody that people hang on every word and they say, wow, this guy, he's got something going on. He's hearing voices and he's built a baseball diamond. Oh my God, did he convince a former civil rights leader to come out here and do all this? Like, wow, there's something to this. So then it's not the commodification of the baseball game. He's literally starting a cult, and he may have murdered a former civil rights leader because, again, James Earl Jones dies at the end of this movie. Spoiler alert. That's a lot of the fun that I have with Field of Dreams is that, like, I don't know how much of that is intentional, but based off of The Good Fight, which again is a fucking phenomenal show, I don't think it's outside of the realm of reason for that reading to be one that was intended to be at least considered.
That's fair. I think that's a fair reading. This movie raises some pretty big existential questions just based on the idea of exiting and entering this field. And like you said, people coming and going, whether they're ghosts or not, whether there's a heaven or a hell or some sort of purgatory for sports people who throw games. That to me, that was a horror movie I wanted to see. It was like, who else is throwing a game? Like, for whatever reason, like when I saw that part where he comes on the field, you might get this reference, Jed. If anyone who's seen the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror number one, where Homer's getting tried by a Devil Flanders and he conjures up like the Broad Street Bullies, who's like the 76 Flyers. They just conjure up through these flames. And I was like, to me, that's a horror movie. The 76 Broad Street Bullies just conjured up in your backyard in a rink. Oh, babe, get the gun. I'm not going out to play hockey with those boys. Like, to me, that was a horror movie with zombie 76 Flyers. But
God. To touch on what you said, Jordan, about like the commodification of this film, it is interesting because now there is that annual Field of Dreams game. They build a stadium and a field literally next door to the set of this film. And to tie that into what you said, Jed, as Kevin Costner is this like salt of the earth cultish figure.
Yeah.
His appearances even have this otherworldliness, but I definitely see him as this in a secular way because he's not religious. I don't know if he is, but the religion of Hollywood, maybe, or the religion of film, or religion of nostalgia. He has another sense of the pastoral. Like, he's like a pastor. He's like a bishop. He's like a Christian evangelical leader. And, you know, there's the fire and brimstone types, right, that we see a lot of. There's the smarmy Joel Esteen, or what is the...
Yeah, Joel Esteen.
Esteen, yeah, that type. And then there is this really suave and smooth and tender and gentle type. He definitely captures that. And I watched I think it was the very first ever Field of Dreams games, and it had the White Sox and I think the Yankees. It was a fantastic game, like home run in the like bottom of the ninth to win it. Amazing setting, just gorgeous, right? And that space cannot just capture light in a boring way. Like, it's just so magical. It's so Terrence Malickian, right? Like, the end of the film, that sunset hour is utterly stunning and picturesque. But they started the game with Kevin Costner there walking out of the cornfields. And even that, even this commodified NBC 4 o'clock event, like, gave you chills and goosebumps. It's like so powerful. I think one of the strongest points of this film is that. And the way they worked that home run, that cornfield barrier, mm-hmm. as this threshold, and this threshold that has significance, symbolic and metaphorical, mm-hmm. of the afterlife, of like the unknown. Like, I thought of, oddly enough, like that movie The Shimmering, right? Or those types of things where you have a force field and you walk through it and you've somehow like gone into another dimension, right? That was what this is doing in a very quotidian way, which I love. I love how everyday or banal the idea of like walking into the corn is as this spiritual mechanism. And I think that is a really strong point. What's really curious about this film that we're already bringing up, though, is that like the functions of the metaphors and the functions of the magical realism are so constantly shifting that it's almost impossible to get your bearings of like any logic. There is literally no internal logic. And Jed, you kind of mentioned David Lynch, and you're not that far off here. Like, it's Lynchian in the sense that, like, there is no internal logic to this.
Yeah.
And one reading is that it's completely lazy writing, right? And it's written, you said it, you know, it was the director and writer, but it was also a novel, right? And it was written by William Kinsella, who is a creative writer, MFA student at the University of Iowa. So you can see how this is definitely Foster, right? He's living in Iowa, loves baseball, puts all these things together, right? So that's one reading, is that it's just like every easy excuse to push a treacly story forward. And I'll get into a few of those elements and nitpicks in a second, because I think they are real and warranted and worthy of discussion. But then there's this other weird reading that it's like super esoteric and purposely illogical. And that's the whole fun. Like, that is the essence of this story. And that's the magic of it. And so I want you to kind of sell or just go on, elaborate on that really intriguing association you had with David Lynch, or that world of the avant-garde, even of like just pure nonsensical on purpose existentialism.
Well, I mean, if you look at it from a writing perspective, it seems like this story kind of functions as a self-challenge of sorts. How can I take the concept of Deus Ex Machina, you know, the God in the machine, or whatever it translates to, the idea of something coming out of nowhere to dictate the changes in your story? Like, how can I take Deus Ex Machina and make an entire story out of that? Every single plot beat and every single shift in this movie without fail is a result of Deus Ex Machina. I mean, if you build it, they will come. He hears this whisper. He barely questions it. He thinks he's crazy for all of like a minute of the movie. And then he's like, all right, fuck it. I'm going to build a baseball field. Let's do that. Here's another voice that says, ease his pain. And it doesn't take him long to figure out. He's like, well, my favorite writer, you want me to ease my favorite writer's pain? Like, it's such a fucking stretch. And like, it gets almost comical at a certain point, because like, tells him to go the distance. And he's just like, what do you mean? Just go the distance to Chisholm, Minnesota, where fucking the former baseball guy is now a doctor who might be a ghost. It's preposterous, but like, it's so fucking dope too. Like, if we're tying this into the idea of like it being Lynchian, like everything in a David Lynch film feels as if there is a purpose, even if it's not easily within your grasp. It feels like something is happening for a reason. And that's kind of the guiding logic behind Field of Dreams. Like, all of this has to be happening for a reason. All of this has to have a reason as we do it. And I think that, like, if you want to go back to what you were saying, Paul, about how, you know, you could say it's just lazy storytelling, like 100% you can view it that way. And quite reasonably so, because what I just described, even saying it out loud, sounds like a fucking mess. It sounds like bad storytelling. And yet, why do I not think it's bad storytelling? Like, the reason that I think that this works is because all of this film hinges off of a very simple desire. How can you tell this story about a man getting to basically say hi and play catch with his dead dad in a reasonable way? And the answer to that question is, there is no fucking reasonable way for that to happen. So let's abandon reasonability. And it feels like wish fulfillment in a way, but also a way for kind of just that, like, circling back to what I was initially saying, that idea of how can we make a story only about Deus Ex Machina? Therefore, I look at this film as kind of a writing exercise, and a very interesting one at that, because that's kind of a bold fucking move to be like, everything hinges on Deus Ex Machina. Print it.
To a T, you brought up the trope, the gimmick that was driving me crazy throughout. And yes, they all are hinging on that. But the one that really got under my skin was the connection at the PTA meeting to Terrence Mann when his wife is going off. And what's hilarious, I had two really funny interactions with my wife who did not really watch this, but was doing chores and doing various things around the house and kind of hearing moments and then asking me questions, is that she asked, so why is he going to New York now to see this like recluse writer, right? By the way, just to our audience, it's based off of J.D. Salinger, who he got the real author got sued when he tried to write in J.D. Salinger, which is even more just like, I'm going to throw whatever I want in, like that's personal, just kind of crazy, which I kind of like. It's just kind of like, I'm just going to make this some weird soup of stuff. But anyways, me trying to like I don't know, man up that I'm like prepping for a podcast and I'm following this film tightly, could not for the life of me give any justification for why he somehow made that connection to it, besides the fact that he is this weird sorcerer with eldritch powers who like was summoned from hearing his wife talk and defend Terrence Mann's books against the, you know, the pitchfork, crazy right-wing cornbread bumpkins, right? Like modern day Florida, who are trying to ban every book under the sun. And then what really threw me off though, is the fact that he's like scribbling on like a pad and then like suddenly writes his name. Like there was a connection being made, but there's zero connection being made here besides the fact that like, this is where the plot needs to go. And it was in the air. And so there's two minds again. I don't want to go too deep, but there's two minds. One mind is that I get really like acrimonious because I know a lot of American viewers who love this are of the sheepish sort who are like buying into this. Like, are they are of that bent? I get really pessimistic. I'm just like, this is fucking dumb. Like this shit is lame. And then there's the sense of like the Jeds of the world who understand that it's nonsense and that it's trying to use like intellectual sleight of hand, but still see something magical about it. And that cognitive dissonance is what really made this a weird ass viewing for me.
Oh yeah, man. Like, I mean, when I watch this movie, like I feel like I'm a living fucking galaxy brain meme. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like, you know, you've got the like soft brain that's just like, you know, Field of Dreams made me cry. And then like the next one is like actually Field of Dreams is a big metaphor for, you know, civil rights and justices and, you know, the death of liberalism. And then you got the bigger one that's just like, it's fucking nonsense and it made me cry. Like, and that's kind of how I feel with Field of Dreams. Cause like when you think too long about it, like the simplest answer, obviously, is what I've settled on. I've thought about this movie a lot since I watched it. This is the easy way to talk about it for me, is to say that it's just walking Deus Ex Machina through and through. But like, it took like to curb like a TV tropes phrase, like some epileptic trees for me to be like, well, what about this? Like, what about that? I was like Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny, just like, you know, connecting all the ropes from one thing to another before I just ripped it all down and was just like, it's fucking nonsense, but like, it's good nonsense. Like, it's the kind of nonsense I can connect with, kind of like David Lynch. Like, it's the type of stuff that if you want to engage with it, you can find meaning and also a sense of inner logic within it, but also you can just lizard brain it and be like, this is fucking cool. And that's ultimately where I land with Field of Dreams. Like, I had a lot of fun watching it, rewatching it for the show, and also big Kevin Costner fan, so here we are.
Yeah, I like that you do bring up though that there is some inner logic, right? And I want to be sincere or earnest here in the three of us at least trying to work out some of the logic. And there's some moments I really thought were well done. Like when he shows up in Minnesota to see Moonlight Graham and the accountant or cleric tells him that he passed away a few years ago, right? And so he walks outside and suddenly he's transported back in time. There's this interplay of like, there's the real, and then there's like the imagined real, right? There's the objective real and the subjective real. And then he has this really meaningful conversation with this character that, you know, he learns that all he wants to do is have one at bat. And then a few scenes later, cut forth, and he's picking up a hitchhiker, right? And slowly, very gradually, we start to catch the clues that, oh my gosh, this is the same guy younger, right? This is Archie Graham. And when if anyone hadn't caught on to all of the breadcrumbs yet, right? When he winks in his at bat, oh, the light bulbs go off. And so there's something interesting going on there. There's also an interesting liminality with the fact that Costner's character, his wife and the daughter can see the magic, right? They can see the baseball players. And this is a common trope, right? This is angels in the outfield, right? The kids can see the angels. No one else can see the angels, right? But that had such a logic, such an easy logic, right? They had the wish and only they could see it. No one else could see it, right? Because they believed. They were in on the imaginative domain. But here it's a little more ambiguous. Like, why can't the realtor brother see, who's trying to, I guess, look out for his sister, right? Because they are going to foreclose the house. He's practical. He's pragmatic. But he's the one who, I love the way they shot it, like walks right past the pitch in the game, right? He obviously can't see it. And so at least we didn't have that old harebrained generic trope of the crazy one who's trying to get everyone to convert because he has some people who are seeing around him. So they don't go too far in that, which is nice. I like, we've done that enough in enough movies. But I was just curious, like, what took or what gave insofar as the brother saw, right? And the last thing I wanted to bring up, so I had two so far. The third one is that you mentioned that James Earl Grey, who's also iconic in this, right? A legend, as you put, he dies at the end. Yeah. I didn't actually even have that reading. I don't know what reading I had though, but I want to know, like, where's the logic there? Like, what was your reading of that?
Well, like, so are you talking about the sequence when he finally walks into the cornfield and disappears?
Yeah, because like so much of this was like there was almost no barrier anymore.
The best way that I can kind of, how do I put this? Rationalize is if you look at it through two different lenses. So number one is if we go back to that like kind of culty lens that I've been talking about, you can look at this as the parable that the cult leader is telling his followers. Like, this is the scripture. This is the scripture of the book of Kevin Costner. You know what I mean? And in that, a lot of scripture and a lot of religious texts do not make sense because they don't have to. They make sense as metaphors. They make sense as messages for the message, right? And so if you look at this, I think Jordan even said this like as kind of a far back callback, like from an hour ago, you mentioned that this is like, you know, kind of a religious parable in a way. And so if you look at that through the context of this being a cult leader story, then the conclusion I have with that is that James Earl Jones walked into the cornfield, and that's a metaphor or, you know, a simile, whatever, for a man who died. You know, he died for the sins of America. He died for the sins of the father. He died for any which way, whatever. If you look at it any other way, it still represents death, but in a more literal sense in terms of the film's inner logic. And Paul, this is kind of similar to what you're saying. Like, if we're blurring the lines with life and death and who's alive and who's dead and all of that, then him walking into the cornfield is just literally how people can die in a world where the ghosts of blacklisted baseball players randomly appear on an Iowa cornfield baseball diamond. You know what I mean? Just another thing that is slightly nonsensical slash surreal about this story. But I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever that that is meant to represent James Earl Jones's character passing away, no matter what.
I guess my second question then for everyone is, what is the mechanism that allows them to see these ghosts? They appear, and I love actually how naturalistic it is, and almost we don't have to have like seven scenes of like the shock and awe. Like, it's quite hilarious how quickly everyone gets on board with just the fact that like, oh, there's a bunch of 1917 baseball players who are blacklisted, or, you know, Ray Liotta's just hanging out in this glowy angelic light. And there's just a bunch of strange men right in our middle of nowhere, Iowa fields, playing baseball, right? And let's bring my daughter and wife. Let's watch them. Let's have a good time, drink a beer. But like, symbolically, like, do you have to believe? Like, the ends with that aerial shot, right? The camera pans up and you see the lights coming in, which does work very beautifully now with the fact that they have a yearly game that brings in the whores and makes money, right? It actually is a real life phenomena, what this film is pitching. But are they going to watch the ghosts, or just a feeling that they are going to sell them their own nostalgia? Because this feels like a very personal nostalgia. This feels like everyone's dealing with their own demons, their own regrets. And so like, they do have that long speech of like a roundabout way of saying like, we're going to take their money for a spiritual or sacred reason, right? Like, they're going to give us their crisp $20 bills, and we're going to give them the nostalgia they so desperately crave. I just thought, okay, like, it's just this bleak National Lampoon-esque type of world where like, you get 1 week of vacation and you're going to see, like I said, this attraction, right? Whether it be a tiger encampment or a mermaid thing in Florida or in Iowa. Now you get to watch, maybe they could hire ex-ball players and dress up in cosplay. That would make sense, right? Have like an impersonation of Babe Ruth, you know, an impersonation of Shirtless Joe, right? That would be brilliant. We haven't done that. Anyone out there listening, that's a good idea. I coined that. But anyways, like, what is the mechanism they're trying to tell us? Like, what are these people going to see? And I'm not trying to be facetious here. I get that this isn't literal, but like, do they want us to think that like, they're selling like nostalgia is this meaningful factor? Like, what is this journey relying on? Because it is trying to sell us like that he has this reconciliation with his father. But like, why does he have to go to all these degrees to reconcile with his father when he really just needed to sit down in the cornfields and reflect? and meditate or something. You know what I mean? Like
the other question is like, why do you have to bankrupt the farm just to save the farm?
Yeah, and I'm being facetious. Very,
like, I'm with Jed. Like I think Jed's idea of how do you say
Deus Ex Machina, and I could be pronouncing that too. Like, I mean, I think it's Deus Ex Machina. It's Latin, I believe. Like I said, I think it means God in the machine, but I could be wrong about that.
It's a great thesis, and I do think it's one of the reasons this movie works so well, because I'm with Paul. I have to stop thinking about it at some point, because you never ask yourself who's the voice, right? But this, like, does it really matter? Like you said, is also a lot of it, because it's like this whole speech is just selling baseball and selling sports, right? You can replace baseball with a lot of other sports and kind of do the same thing, right? I'm kind of with you in the end, kind of like what we're getting in here, what's a spectacle, what's being sold? Because like the rules aren't the same as, like you mentioned, Angels in the Outfield, right? There's rules they can't play in the championship game, right? It seems like there should be a rule here where you can't exploit this one financially, but that's not really the thing, right? It's just a sentiment as a viewer, right? But the movie does, I'm not cracking up on the movie. I kind of disregards that because we're on it for the journey. Father, especially watching it now, we know it's a middle-aged dude who has daddy issues. That's the other thing, is it's just a boomer movie. It's a boomer dude who's like, you know, grew up with a dad who's distant, and he never thought of him as a man, as an individual, right? And that's the big epiphany, is my dad was, you know, an ex-baseball player and he had a life of his own. Wow. Me being dumbing it down, but you kind of get that midway. Like, that's what's driving all this, is it's just that old, you know, like a lot of movies, just the search for the father. Yeah. Is just super pronounced in this, in ways, like we said, it's one of the more cliche sports tropes though too, right? We talked about this with like Gordon Bombay. We always talk about him as like, you know, the drunk dude who coached the kids, right? But it's a lot about him being like lack of a father figure, right? Mm-hmm. And longing for the father he didn't get to, you know, always talk to, but his dad showed up for the games, right? It's kind of that connection, but we have it in reverse. The father who didn't really care about his games, he always wanted to stick it to his dad, right? It's just that story. It's a cat's in the cradle kind of story, right? Of the things you want to say, you don't get to say. And you definitely get that right away, but it's disguised in a fun, just like off the walls journey that, like you said, borderlines on magical, borderlines on religious, but doesn't really go into any specific godly claim. Like, as a kid, I always thought this was more of a God movie. Like I said, I think I use that word, like a God movie. It's really not though, right? It's just this weird spiritual claim. Like, and it's, it has, like, we kind of trace it through. It has to do with this weird upbringing of the distant father choosing college instead of this path, like the father training him into baseball, it sounded like, but him rejecting it, but weirdly growing up to do the same thing to his daughter, right? By passing it into her. She knows more about baseball than she knows about farming, I imagine, right? Based on the conversations they have, right? It's kind of that tradition as well. And also not seeing, you know, the irony of him not seeing the relationship he's forging with his daughter, who he's absent father in this movie. And I say it like, not like he's just abandoning them, right? But in weirdly doing the same thing in the same pattern, right? And that's just like, it's a good message though, because it's weirdly human, right? It's the unintentional things we do, because we're all individuals with these roles, but we're all searching, if you will, like for the next thing, the next challenge, the next calling, right? So I do like the way it kind of breaks down in that way. It's a very complicated movie, like as you dissect it.
I think another thing to consider too is that, like, if you look at it through like kind of a spiritual lens, like you were mentioning too, I mean, just that idea of the cars kind of flooding into the field at the end, it can take on like a number of meanings, because there's like the cynical reading, which you guys have brought about, like the commodification of baseball. There's also the, you know, more spiritual, less culty way to look at it. Like, baseball itself is the religion. Like, you know, this is the proof positive that people will come if you give them a game worth watching. I mean, if we're, you know, sticking to the theme of your guys's podcast, I do think that probably is the most on the nose yet realistic way that you can read this movie, is that it's all just a way of saying that, like, we all have daddy issues, but all of us, you know, can put that aside to come together for, you know, a good game of baseball, especially a game worth watching, like a 1919 blacklisted players. Like, I mean, if you told me that I could go see the ghosts of a blacklisted baseball team, like play a baseball game right now, like, you goddamn bet I would drive to Iowa to go see that. That sounds fucking awesome. If we're taking it literally, then yeah, that 100%. Going back to the culty thing, the car's pulling up, that's sinister. Put some fucking like sinister strings, like just like, you know, just like a, and that's like the end of a Jordan Peele movie. That's like the fucking like end of Us. Like, oh shit, like it's gonna go down. Boom, credits.
Yeah, no, I mean, I read it also as like, nope, with the spectacle, right? They're all coming to see the spectacle in the grandstands in the middle of nowhere. Whereas Nope's only Acton. It's not that far out of LA, but for us AV people. But there was something also interesting at the end about narcissism, right? Because like, this is coming at the end of the 80s, right? Which was the me generation, right? It was this time of me, the Reaganomics. And Kevin Costner has a little tantrum at the end. The whole movie, he's really floats, right? He's really even keeled, even though the whole movie is kind of propping him up, right? And it's all his journey and it's all kind of slightly selfish journey. There's something very also selfless about it. There's something that feels inevitable about it. Like he can't help but be summoned, right? And it's not only him, right? That's why this logic is so bizarre. It's not only like that he's believing or needs so deeply to have a paradigm shift in his life that his family is just by proximity and intimacy, seeing his reality manifest and come to life, or maybe you could still read it that way, but his wife even has the same dream as him, right? A Fenway Park, for example. So the fairy dust magic is working on a very widespread plane here. It's happening to everyone. It's not just Costner. But then by the end, like he gets really kind of pissy and literally asks Ray Liotta, right? Shirtless Joe Jackson, what about me? Like, what do I get out of this whole ordeal? Suddenly this thing that was starting to become more altruistic, right? You kind of feel like he really just wants to give Moonlight Graham his last chance to have that one pitch. He really wants to ease the pain of Terrence Mann, even though I don't even know how he truly eases a dude's pain, just by hanging out with him, I guess, just by bringing a recluse out into public. Like, what did Terrence Mann get out of this whole ordeal? Like, I don't know. I don't get that. Like, it never really cohered for me. It never really came around.
The only thing I got out of that was either he had to be hearing voices before he heard a voice along with him at that stadium. And it was just like a confirmation. Like you said, this shit's out there. Yeah. But other than that, I was kind of with you. I was like, he heard the voice. I was like, does that mean you've heard voices before? And that's kind of why you're a reclusive old stay out of the spotlight thing. But that's a valid question, though.
No, but like when he walks into the cornfield at the end, let's say he died, right? Like, but he's happy, right? There's a solace. There's a catharsis going on.
Yeah.
What happened in the journey that changed his perspective? Like, what is his character arc? I'm very confused about a lot of like very elemental things about
it. For him is he had something to actually write about again. And it sounds like, honestly, if I put it blank, he has this weird phenomenon of fucking baseball ghost that he's going to go walk through to, right? I think he tells him to do that. Like, tell me what's up with it or something. Like, give us a report on it, right? But he is a writer who's lost his mojo, right? And he has like very good reason. It's like, he's just like, everyone's too radical now. And like, they just look for me for like the truth. And like, I don't even know the truth, right? And like, and it's like kind of him still like, oh, I have an opportunity here to actually like search for the truth again, in quotes, in that writerly pursuit, right? Like what he used to have. Because like he said, he's like a software dude. He leaves writing to write software that made kids like, grab this exact words, but made him like not violent or something like that, pretty much. It wasn't violent video games, was what he's doing, right? But like, yeah, I feel like it was like a reinvigoration of his passion, right? Because all this is about also going back to like the daddy issues. It's also about, you know, male disparity of what could have been, right? For those who dwell too much on the past or ambition or what they perceive as ambition they didn't like act on. Because that's Kevin Costner's issue with his dad, is that dad didn't act on his ambition. We find out later dad did. And it's him, quote unquote, acting on his ambition. But we've kind of discussed, he doesn't really know what that ambition is. It's just his voice, right? And that's him, if we will, discovering his ambition, like we said, was really him, this drive for knowing his dad. So I think like with Terrence, right, his is like just that confirmation of like that ambition being, like you said, like kind of charged up and like you said, going forth into this weird ethereal, whatever you call it, like force field thing. And it's kind of left to the viewer.
I mean, I think I could see that too. I mean, if I remember correctly, isn't there like some line in this movie that Terrence Mann says about people coming to like relive their childhood innocence or something like that?
I believe so.
The thing is that like for him, I mean, like you were mentioning, he transitioned to something that helped kids, even if it like didn't help kids, but it left him kind of listless. He wasn't as fulfilled as he once was as a writer and like a civil rights leader, all of those things. And I like this idea that you're floating around of him kind of finding the ultimate truth within this. And I mean, whether that's a truth in death or it's a truth within something that has previously been believed to never be possible, which if you find the possible within the impossible, that's the pursuit of creativity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the best light bulb moments that all of us have had as musicians, for instance, is when we figure out that riff or we figure out that bass line or that note that we couldn't hit before as a singer that feels like a revelation. And I mean, I feel like you can also then take this as like, you know, the pursuit of creativity in a way, on his story, at least. This is the ultimate creative, you know, attaining. He can not necessarily write about it because, again, I firmly believe he fucking died, but he can at least find the truth, which, if as somebody who has always been interested in the truth, makes him the character that is most likely to have that appeal to him. Mm. I'm really on that wavelength. I like that because I never considered that before. This is all just free association.
Yeah, no, that's what I was hoping for. Like a spontaneous, like organic understanding a little bit more, or hammering out of some of these themes and metaphors and characters that personally, I guess, for like reasons of incompetence, I couldn't synthesize. And I know that like a lot of this isn't meant to be synthesized, but like, for example, Terrence Mann's character arc, I was just left a little baffled. But now, like, as you're talking, I do see that like that line about reporting, it really means a lot. I think that his role is to become like a writer that unifies again. Like his famous book in this film is The Boat Rocker, right? Like someone who like challenges authority, who kind of is unorthodox and for a good reason, right? Like he's a pacifist, we know, and he's countercultural, right? And he's definitely upsetting people because he's the one that's creating this whole PTA hysteria, right? Aren't they arguing about his book at that meeting? And they're trying to ban his books and burn his books. You know, that's when Kevin Costner's wife fends off all the fascists in her quick vote, her spontaneous vote, which was fun, which is hilarious because it also reconciles my reading of this movie as like a thinly veiled metaphor of a, like an LSD or acid trip, like a psychedelic trip. And what I love is that that is something that is not palatable for the vast majority of Americans. And the fact that they somehow coded that in like the most Heartland is Heaven porn fed narrative with this cuddly score, right? It's like just so middle brow. And I mean that in a good way, right? But then there's these radical underpinnings that I love that fusion as well going on. And the fact that maybe that's his arc is that he's found a topic or a narrative or something to report on that's going to connect him again with the everyman, with the Americans, with the public, with the majority of people, because that's his whole problem, right? He's a recluse and he's misanthropic, and which makes sense because J.D. Salinger, he really wanted that to be the character, right? It's famous for that, right? He's like an old grump who wrote one of the most famous books about being a disobedient and like questioning everything, right? With Holden Caulfield. And I read that there's a lot of connections or inspiration taken from all of his books, even with the characters' names. I don't want to get too deep into that, but there's a lot of little references to J.D. Salinger here. So yeah, that definitely works for me pretty well. The last thing is that there's a really cool Easter egg that I read about that really has, I think, a cool metaphysical significance, is that in the amazing early montage, I absolutely adored that. That was probably my favorite part looking back at the whole film. I really love the first 3 minutes where he's like just talking about his parents and his upbringing and his life. It just moved at a very whimsical, lovely and romantic in a sad but like bittersweet way. There's a picture that it shows of his father, right, in the baseball glove. That picture and image is replicated exactly when his father appears finally in the film. And to me, that is meaningful because where I read this was one of these like clickbaity articles about like 10 things you didn't see or in Field of Dreams. And they were asking a bunch of questions like, does this mess with the timeline? I mean, I say this in that tone I just switched to sounded like I was being smarmy and critical, which is ironic because I guess their take was mine. They're being very like hard on these things, right? And trying to like overthink them. But what I thought really worked well about this juxtaposition or this reiteration of the same image is that it shows that all these are based on his internal associations. I felt like, oh, the picture has come to life. And that really made it resonate, make sense. Oh, it's a manifestation of something that was already in his psyche. And our memory is so embedded with pictures. I know this personally. When I think about like my travels, and I don't want to go too deep on a tangent, right? It's always pictures that first lead me into specific localized experiential memories. You would think maybe it'd be experiences and senses, but for me, it's like always the image, and the image usually comes from an actual picture because I've seen it so many times that it's so ingrained at the top of my psyche. So anyways, I really like that about that. It was pretty interesting to me that they had that type of Easter egg that like kind of, I guess, substantiated the reading though, that this is more of a spiritual journey. It's almost like an ayahuasca vision of someone trying to reconnect with the past and also see a future for themselves. It's odd that like he wouldn't have as much agency, but I guess that's what you need to have faith. You need to have that receptivity. So I think that's intriguing too. And I think that was one of the conflicts I had throughout, because if so much of this was in a weird way, Heideggerian, I don't want to get deep into that either. But like he has this thing about the ecstatic vision. It's very existential. And it's like this moment of truth. And it's definitely like, oh, this is a moment of truth. All these voice moments, right? That make no sense, but that show us the like path. Yet those are very much a thing of autonomous, like forward agency. There's some level of like everything in your life collapsing in a moment where you see everything in clarity and total holistic permanence. Whereas this is a very different and more passive form in which he's turned into a detective, right? It's a scavenger hunt. And that was something that was for no reason or fault of the movies doing bugging me. Cause you know, I had this ready-made reading of it, like, and it wasn't matching up to that or tailoring on to that. But any last thoughts about this idea of faith or vision or the moment of truth or ecstatic vision being from the external, right? Being from something above you, something holy, right? Or religious, theological, versus something that is more phenomenological, that's based in reflection, cognition, and so forth.
Well, I mean, like, I think that the film's own internal logic would tend to agree with you in that regard, because there's one other Easter egg in this film that we haven't even talked about at all. And that's the fact that the voice itself, if you build it, they will come. There's no credit for that voice. And to this day, everybody that's worked on this film has been very dodgy about who provided that voice. It makes the voice kind of, to me, be this kind of detached spiritual presence within the film that also, because nobody will say who it is inexplainable. I think that that's interesting, especially with everything that you are saying about this film and how it presents itself and how it expresses itself. Because if you don't know who that voice is, then it's the voice, and it's the voice of God. Is it the voice of baseball? Is it his father? Is it, by the way, Paul, you've been saying shirtless Joe Jackson. It's shoeless Joe Jackson. Like,
would have been a better character, by the way. Imagine Ray Liotta out there just topless the whole movie with a bat.
Fucking real.
What a faux pas.
What's up? I'm shirtless Joe Jackson, bitch.
His wife's like, you better go out there and meet him, Ray.
For a film about wish fulfillment, I was just hoping Ray Liotta was shirtless.
Yeah, just shirtless Ray Liotta.
Just ripped, you know?
No dreaming.
Rest in peace.
But yeah, man, like I think that you're onto something with that for sure. What about you, Jordan? Like, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think the voice is kind of, like I said, one of the reasons so many dudes like this movie, because you can just attach it to whatever you want. It's such a like tug at so many nostalgic strings, father-son strings, midlife crisis strings. Across audiences, it's just so easy to just like pick and choose how you want it to be. It's a settling way of ending. It's a pretty ambitious ending, right? But it's pretty settling because you can kind of just pick it, kind of have whatever angle you're coming from, especially as a first time viewer. I'm trying to think of this first time as a kid. Like I said, I always use that word. Like, first time as a kid, that's a voice of God. Because that's a perception I think I have of voices and stuff like that. Whereas now it's something either, I think psychologically, maybe as I look at this one, like kind of like we said, the idea that he never actually looks into the craziness, he just kind of runs through it. But then at the same time, when I look at him and James Earl Jones' character, forget his character's name, right? It's almost like a confirmation of the crazy in someone else, right? That kindred other who's also as insane as you, because you're hearing something, right? So I felt like this time it was almost like a real thing. Whereas the first time, like you said, it was a higher calling, etc. But I feel like the idea of confirmation on some of the characters, and then one thing I was struggling with was like, Paul, what qualifies someone to see this stuff, right? But I felt like James Earl Jones, like the idea that they both kind of had these crises and that this was somehow tied to this crisis, right? Like I mentioned, James Earl Jones is this like lack of ambition. And like I said, even Kevin Costner's character, it is kind of a mid-age crisis thing, right? He kind of, like I said, leaves the family for a bit to go find himself, if you will. He says like it's a really supportive wife. She just lets him build a baseball field, right? Instead of going and getting like the Corvette and a new wife, she's like, let him just build a baseball field and do his thing. It just speaks to a lot of levels. I can see it's a fitting ending to this. Mm-hmm. I can see why, like we said, why it's one of the top ones on our podcast. People say sports movies, what's your favorite?
I wish it maybe leaned into that a little bit more, that idea of like the midlife crisis, which it definitely leans into, right? But like one of my readings, right, is that like it's someone who is sick of the practical, right? And sick of the humdrum existence that they're living. And it is interesting that, like, it's someone who's just basically tending to corn, right? Something that feeds people, but that gives very little like intellectual gratification, and to doing something that's a little bit more in the arts or entertainment, right? At the end, right? Like, he's basically peddling nostalgia by the end, to wrap it up. Even the one thing that we didn't bring up that I'm not as fluent in, but that would be an interesting reading out there, would be like a Jungian reading, or like a Freudian reading, or like a psychoanalytic reading, because this is so much in the dreamscape, right? In the dream world. Follows a dream logic. I mean, the byline in Rotten Tomatoes is, this is situated between third base and Twilight Zone. I love that, right? It's pretty good. It's definitely this weird modern day fairy tale that works on a level that is more free association than most films, as illogical as most films are even. That makes it a unique, like, American classic. And so on that note, this film also, as our conversation has hinted at, is somewhat divisive, actually. It's a huge cult classic, of course, and it's beloved, right? Like Shawshank Redemption, or like Rocky, or like all these dad movies and sports movies and classics. But like on Metacritic, it only got a 57 out of 100, right? But then on CinemaScore, right, where it balances the audience a lot and everything, it has an A on a scale of A plus to F, which is very, very high. So this is a populist home run.
Yeah.
And it's a critical bunt, or like pop fly, like complete, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum there. And so on that note, or on your own context, I want to know where we all fall on this one. Is it an underdog film, despite or inclusive of all its discourse and applause or, you know, disdain? Or is it an overrated film?
I don't think it's overrated at all. I mean, the thing is that I am 99% certain that the average film goer probably has the same sort of recollection that it sounds like all of us do, in that we think we've seen this film because of how prevalent it's become in pop culture. But there's a good chance that we haven't seen it, if we're, of course, our age or younger. I mean, I'm 35. I know you guys are like roughly the same age as me. And I am fairly certain that almost nobody from our age downward that's not like really just in tune with cinema and watching the Best Picture nominees of 1990. You know, most people probably haven't watched this movie recently. I mean, I don't think it's as part of the pop culture of 2023 as it was the pop culture of the 1990s, or even the pop culture of the early 2000s. So I think that it does come into a place of being, strangely, for a film that was a pretty fucking huge hit, like, it's a bit of an underdog now, for sure. Even if you have seen the film, I think that it's like a cliche, but I feel like a lot of people listening to this that have heard us talk, you know, ad nauseum about, you know, the surrealism of this, are just like, Field of Dreams? Surreal? Like, what? Like, you rewatch this film now and it's like, it's pretty plain as day. Like, this is a fucking weird movie. It is a very strange movie if you pay even the slightest bit of attention to it. The logic, the fucking storytelling beats, the James Earl Jones of it all. I mean, it's just, it's a strange movie. And I think that bare minimum, even if you watch it and still think it's a little too cloying, a little too manipulative, and I see those points of view, you got to at least give it credit. It has more on its mind than it appears to have. And that's, I think, undeniable when you watch it nowadays. So underdog, that's my vote. I don't know if you guys do that, like you press a button, like underdog.
Oh, we need to do that now.
Yeah, that's great. I will go next because I think Jordan is the most enigmatic here, and I'll keep it 1-1. I will call this overrated. And we had a very, I think, rounded discussion of this, but we've had so many people come on and put this as in their top three of sports films. And so my context is specifically of sports films and how this is at the very, very upper echelon of that pantheon. And I think that a lot of people love this for reasons to me that get under my skin a little. I think that they buy into the cloying sentimentality. I don't think that they get on board for how existentially weird and bizarre this film is. And that's an interesting sort of projection to make, and it's kind of a haughty and supercilious one. But I think that that ultimately is still what slightly rubs me the wrong way about this movie. And the way that the score is so simultaneously effective But as you said yourself, Jed, you take out that score and you have a horror film. Mm-hmm. Also, if you take out that score, you might not have a film at all. Like, it might just not work. And so, like, that is why I might call this an overrated film. Like, I think that the score does so much of the heavy lifting throughout. You know, Kevin Costner, too. You take a few elements out. And you could do that with any film, I guess. But, like, when it's the score, that always is a pet peeve of mine. And there's a lot of films that I absolutely adore and love and wonder about that. So I'm going to stick with my overrated here, because I don't give enough overrated on this pod. So I also wanted to have more range. And also because it is so hyped in a lot of circles that we exist in, that I know I'm probably pissing some of our listeners off right now as I speak. But suck it. It's overrated.
Oh, man. All right. So this is when I jumped around with both watching it and our discussion, like, really helped move the needle on this one. So I was coming really hard as overrated, complete bias. Midway point, I was leaning a little more. This is an underdog. Like you said, there's a lot of thoughts going on with, for me, this idea of, like, it ending on come see our possible portal to hell or heaven or whatever, based on whatever you're at in life, I guess, right now. Pay $20, you'll find out. Cool. I like the way it ended. Like I said, I came into it thinking it was this boring dad movie. It was much more than that. And I think it's one of those ones, like, I'm not going to go rewatch anytime soon. But when I come back to rewatch, I'm going to have, like, such an investigative eye. It's kind of like we're talking pre-podcast about, like, looking forward to watching Nope again. This is what I feel like this one will actually be. So I think I'm going to go ahead and give it an underdog. I was unfairly hard on it coming in. And I think I was swayed, particularly by our discussion. There's a lot to really, like, dive into beyond what we, like we said, what we know about it already, either through pop culture, through conversation, if you're our age, through the movie cover at Blockbuster. There's a lot more to that. So
yeah,
I look forward to seeing it again.
Also, because I know for a fact that you guys are going to, you know, cut some things out, condense this episode for everybody listening at home, like, if this soundbite makes the episode, we've been talking about this one movie for 2.5 hours, like almost the entire length of Waterworld, Kevin Costner's other film from the 90s. There's a lot that can be said about Field of Dreams. I think, like, I really do think that if it's not clear at this point, like, there's a lot to discuss about this film, and probably even more that, like, all of us missed in it, which is, like, such a weird thing to think about, because at its core, I mean, this is Daddy Issues, the movie. Like, that's what it is. And we could have just ended the episode after that. It's like Field of Dreams, underdog or not, it's Daddy Issues. And then
but yeah, no, you're right. We've definitely tackled a full-length film plus two. I mean, this film goes at such a fast clip, right? I think it's 1 hour and 45. So we've almost done double the time. Anyways, when we're talking about the context and the cultural impact of this film, can't leave out the fact that it was up for 3 major Academy Awards in 1990, Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Original Score. And sending us off, I just want to know everyone's pick, and we're not going to elaborate too long because we've already held you listeners long enough. Who would you choose for the 1990 Best Picture? And we have not only, of course, Field of Dreams, we also have Driving Miss Daisy, Born on the 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, and My Left Foot. So I hope you all know all of these, right? Got Daniel Day-Lewis, Tom Cruise, Morgan Freeman, and Robin Williams. Jordan, you go first on this one. We'll reverse it.
Before this, I was maybe going to go Dead Poets Society or My Left Foot, but now I'm feeling actually Field of Dreams. I'm going to say it's solely based on our discussion.
The only one of these I have not seen is Driving Miss Daisy. So, like, I guess I'm thinking of that as Green Book because of all of the comparisons to Green Book. So with that caveat already mentioned, right, I can't fairly even include that one. I'm giving this to Dead Poets Society. Absolutely adore that movie. Just lives up to the height of American cinema, like a 5 out of 5 for me, which is a rare thing. So I'm going with Dead Poets Society.
If we're going with just these 5, then it's Field of Dreams, no question. Dead Poets Society is a very, very close second, though, Paul, for reasons that you're outlining. I mean, it's a damn fine film and one of Robin Williams' best performances. I mean, God, I got to go Field of Dreams, though. I mean, if I haven't made it clear, I love this fucking movie. And the thing is, though, is that we are also talking about the 1990 Academy Awards. And I think the big elephant in the room there is that Do the Right Thing is not in those nominees. And I would give it to Do the Right Thing. Like, I'm a huge fucking Do the Right Thing fan. I'm a recent Spike Lee fan in general in terms of his other films. Do the Right Thing, when stacked up against really any of these, like, I feel like it's wild that it wasn't nominated at all. That's my pick. right there. But if I have to stick to the five, it's Field of Dreams.
Great. I love that you brought that in, included that. I didn't remember that was a 1989 film, but definitely I think that has lived longer and in almost greater posterity than any of these, which deservedly so, and which is why these are irrelevant at the end of the day. And that's awesome. So I do love that you love this movie so much, and your generosity and depth definitely gave me the impetus to even cover this, because I was personally dreading it to a degree. And it was extremely underrated in that sense. It was underdog in that one sense, that like it was nowhere near as grating as I was fearing for a long time because of all of the dynamic nuances that we brought to the table. So anyways, thanks so much, Jeff, for coming on. This was a blast. Where can our listeners, I guess, just like follow you online?
It's my name on everything, at Jed Bookout. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can try to find me, I guess, on Facebook, though on there it's just Jed, which could make it a little hard to find me. And I also don't accept friend requests, so don't look for me on Facebook. Beyond that, I don't have like anything to promote. I was saying that right before the show. It's like the rare time where I'm like a little in between jobs right now. So that Douglas Sirk thing, if you want me to write about Douglas Sirk for your website, hit me up. I've got some thoughts. And to date, there is no definitive ranking of all 37 Douglas Sirk films on the internet. Let me be your guy. I've got some things. Ooh, to do.
Yeah. All right. Listen to that IndieWire, or I don't know, multiple platforms. I think that they would die for that slant. AV Club before it sucked. I guess sold out. Anyways, Jordan, send us off with where people can interact with us and how they can boost our SEO.
Yeah, definitely. Hit us up on Twitter, on Spotify, any of these places you're listening to our podcast. We're at Cinematic Underdogs. And like we always say, send those chirps. Give us those chirps. We went pretty hard on, we didn't go pretty hard, but we might have ruined Field of Dreams for some people. So if we did, let us know.
Apologies, that's on me. All right, anyways, thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
And the other funny thing that got brought up by my wife was that she asked at the very end, is this actually kind of bad? Without any like self-awareness or irony, I responded, it's kind of corny. And we just sat there for a second. And this is the precise moment when James Earl Jones is walking into the corn. Like the best dad pun unintentionally. And we just died like 7 seconds delayed when it finally dawned on us that like I totally inadvertently did that. So anyways.
Yeah. Or it's the most profound criticism ever, depending on how you break down the end of this movie. Because that cornfield could be anything.